special guest in a Yahoo Finance exclusive. We have Jeffrey Gundlach, the founder and CEO of Double Line Capital. Jeffrey, always great to have you on the program. And as you and I have long talked about, this relationship between the markets and the Fed here, and of course, the fresh record highs. So kind of just stepping back, big picture, what do you make of what's transpired in the markets? What's your overall view?
Well, the Federal Reserve earlier this year pretty much promised that short-term interest rates would stay at zero for at least a couple more years. And they seem to also be interested in controlling a little bit the shape of the yield curve and controlling even long-term interest rates. So the 30-year Treasury bond got up to around 2.5% earlier this year. And now it seems like it can't get above 2%, even though inflation's been increasing. And that's one of the reasons why I say I think the Fed is behind the scenes trying to manipulate interest rates lower at the long end. So they've been extending the maturity of their quantitative easing, which is $80 billion of treasuries per month and $40 billion in mortgage-backed securities. And there's some whispering behind the scenes that maybe they're going to start thinking about tapering that quantitative easing. But as long as it's going on, they keep the bond yields at a very, very low level. I mean, we have negative real interest rates that are rivaling the Jimmy Carter era of the late 70s, with the CPI on the headline at about 5.4 and on the core at about 4.3. Either way you look at it, you're at -3 or -4% real interest rates. And so what I've been talking about for most of this year is that as overvalued as stocks are relative to historical measures like the price earnings ratio or Dr. Shiller's CAPE ratio or price to book and all that sort of stuff, as overvalued as they look by historical measures, they still are cheaper than bonds, treasury bonds. And that's one of the things that's bolstering the U.S. stock market in addition to the stimulus in the economy. So if you look at the inverse of the P.E. ratio, which is kind of gives you a yield on, say, the S&P 500, it's below average on its valuation versus bonds. So simply, bonds are so overvalued versus the inflation rate and versus economic growth and other measures like the copper-gold ratio, all of our typical benchmarks for treasuries that we use and have been very helpful over the years, they all suggest that on a fundamental basis, the 10-year treasury should be at least 100 basis points, if not up to 200 basis points higher than it is versus economic and inflation fundamentals. But it's not there because of the Fed's policy. And as long as the stimulus goes on, the stock market can stay in very overvalued territory. One of the things that I've been noticing for a decade now, even more than a decade, is that the stock market's market capitalization, let's just use the S&P 500. If you take that capitalization of the S&P and compare it to the size of the Fed's balance sheet, which is the consequence of their quantitative easing, which is now over $8 trillion. If you compare the capitalization of the S&P to the size of the Fed's balance sheet, it's almost a constant. And it's been that way with very little variation. It's almost like a law of physics, it feels like, market physics anyway. And so as long as the Fed is expanding its balance sheet, there's a tailwind behind the stock market. And so I think that's one of the reasons you're going to those new highs is that the bonds are so overvalued.
Yeah, it's an interesting analogy you make to almost like a law of physics, if you will. And Jeffrey, you mentioned stocks are still cheap relative to bonds when you look there. I mean, from an investor perspective, though, where are you thinking about wanting to be allocated? Have you kind of shifted your views of how you want to structure a portfolio given the high valuations?
Well, a little bit. I've been for about a past year plus, I started advocating a little over a year ago, kind of the construct of something that was a popular mutual fund back a decade ago called the permanent portfolio. And it's 25% cash, 25% long-term government bonds, 25% stocks, and then 25% gold. And not everybody loves gold, but it's just a placeholder for real assets. I think that with the promise of the Fed at zero interest rates and their stimulus of the economy, the cash percentage should probably be a little bit less than 25%. And gold has been a very poor performer this year, but commodities broadly have done very, very well until May of this year, and now they're going sideways. When it comes to the stock allocation, for the first time in, I think, more than a decade, we at Double Line earlier this year started to allocate to European equities, part of our equity holdings. And the equity market, United States, and the equity market in Europe have been very similar for quite a while now, really since the middle of 2020. The U.S. stock market had been outperforming Europe almost consistently and almost constantly for a decade. But starting in the middle of 2020, they're now moving in lockstep. And I think that the attractiveness of European stocks is based upon their valuation and kind of the structural aspect of the economy in Europe seems to be in sync with the growth that's going on in the globe. So we actually are now favoring European equities. It hasn't worked really for the past year and a half, but it hasn't not worked either. They have the same type of return. And since European equities are so much cheaper from a PE perspective or a Shiller-Cape ratio perspective, and the fact that we believe ultimately that these deficits from the stimulus and from the trade deficit expanding also due to stimulus, that the dollar, although we've been bullish on the dollar for the past several months, it's just a tactical move. We think in the longer run, the dollar really is going to fall fairly sharply because historically, when you run massive budget deficits and simultaneously expanding trade deficits, it's very highly correlated to dollar weakness. What we're in right now with the dollar strength appears to be a counter trend move that may be nearing its end as we move into the end of 2021.
Right. I want to go back and bring something up. You mentioned gold being a poor performer, and it just makes me a little bit curious because we've had a lot of talk about inflation lately. I know you and I have discussed this. You know, I'm wondering why gold has been such a performer, or is it, you know, because, you know, Bitcoin suddenly becoming kind of this inflation hedge, or there's a lot of talk around it being, I guess, kind of a form of insurance. What do you make of that when gold's not performing when we talk about inflation?
That's a very good point. You know, gold has been stuck at 1800. I think it's almost exactly 1800 as we're speaking today. And it got up to around 2000 and then just gave up the ghost. This is about a year ago. And now it's basically it's cheap when it's at 1750 and seems like it's expensive relative to its trading range at 1850. Meanwhile, as you correctly point out, Bitcoin has been on a wild roller coaster, but broadly speaking, it's up a lot. And I think it has to do with the way the government stimulus has been sprinkled around very, very broadly into the economy with stimulus checks going to people. And I do think that the people that receive stimulus are probably more likely to trade Bitcoin than to deal in gold. And so I do think that the stimulus has been a booster or the relative performance of cryptocurrencies. Also, it just seems that governments just seem to be becoming less and less in control of the situation. And there seems to be a sort of a societal cultural theme that people believe that Bitcoin and other cryptos are a little bit outside of the government. I don't agree with that assessment, but as long as that's the mentality of investors or speculators, it can rule the day. And I think that's what's happening with Bitcoin.
Do you see a place for Bitcoin in a portfolio? Which curious, like if you see merits there, have you ever thought about owning the cryptocurrency?
No, it's too risky for me. I think I gravitated to bonds partially because I was assigned to do bonds, you know, 35, 40 years ago, and I had an affinity for it. But bond people are very low risk people. People that want risk, you know, it's difficult to trade in bonds if you are interested in a wild ride because a big day in the bond market is the move of a percent, you know, and Bitcoin can change 20% in an hour. I've seen that happen. So I've never, I give advice on Bitcoin and I'm actually not bullish on Bitcoin. I've been wrong on Bitcoin recently, but I've been broadly bullish on Bitcoin for about 2 years. I'm just not in the short term. But Bitcoin is clearly a tool of speculation, and you know it's a great trading vehicle if you want a lot of action, and I think that's one of the appeals. A lot of people, when you give them $2,000 or $1,200, whatever size a certain stimulus check can be, they feel like they're playing to a certain extent with the house's money, and Bitcoin is a great vehicle for speculation, far greater, better vehicle for speculation than gold. So no, I've never been personally long or short Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned this kind of vehicle for speculation. Maybe it's like the broader theme of what's kind of happening in the markets. How do you kind of see this movie playing out, Jeffrey? How are you thinking about it and like maybe even the longer term consequences?
Well, the longer term consequences of U.S. policies are going to be, it's one of the reasons why I favor non-U.S. stocks, not emerging markets, even though they're super cheap. Emerging market stocks are so cheap compared to developed market stocks, but there's a reason for that cheapness. And that's the COVID problem is so much more significant in emerging markets with healthcare systems and vaccinations not available in many cases. So emerging market equities aren't even, they're not even up this year. So really, I think that the places to be in the long term are going to be emerging markets and non-US entities, because the dollar, my number one conviction, I know I've told you this before, Julia, my number one conviction looking forward a number of years, I'm not talking about the next few months at all, I'm talking about several years, is that the dollar is going to go down. And because of that, I think investors, I've already rotated into European equities. I will rotate very aggressively into emerging market equities. I just think it's too early for that right now. So the dollar going down is another reason why ultimately we talked about, we touched on gold. I think ultimately gold is going to go a lot higher, but it's really in hibernation right now.
Jeffrey, you're just making a point about your strongest conviction on the future of the U.S. dollar. I want to explore this a bit further and help our viewers understand what some of the longer term implications of this might mean, especially for the standing of the U.S. globally.
Well, the U.S. has enjoyed the status of sole reserve currency globally for decades, and it's an incredible benefit. We also have the biggest military in the world, which is kind of goes hand in glove with being a reserve currency, I think. But in the aftermath of the lockdowns and the pandemic that continues to wear on, the strongest economy in the world by far has been the Chinese economy. And the U.S. economy has bounced back with a lot of consumption. A lot of that consumption is going to China. It's one of the reasons China has such a strong economy. So what we're seeing is the United States is starting to fall behind in economic growth. That's not a new thing. That's been going on for a generation, the U.S. falling behind. But the Chinese economy is growing so rapidly that the estimates as to when the Chinese economy will be the largest in the world keep getting pulled forward. 20 years ago, it was thought to be 2050, the Chinese would be bigger than the U.S., and that was 2040. And now it's the estimates are maybe it's in the 2020s, maybe even 2028, the Chinese economy gets bigger. And China's made no secret of the fact that they want to be a global player and have at least a seat at the table of global reserve currency status. And they're spending like crazy on military and have also made no secret of the fact that they want their military to be dominant, maybe the biggest in the world. Also, they have huge savings in China. They have a culture of savings, they sort of the gold medalists of saving historically. And so when you put all those things together with the U.S. growing debt like crazy, we have debt to GDP that is fueling the majority of our so-called economic growth. So is it really economic growth when you borrow money or print money, send checks to people who turn around and buy goods on Amazon in addition to maybe paying down debt and speculating, and these goods come in from China? So we're running our economy in a way that is almost like we're not interested in maintaining global reserve currency status or the largest military or global, let's call it superiority or control. And so as long as we continue to run these policies and we're running them more and more aggressively, we're not pulling back on them in any way. We are looking at a roadmap that is clearly headed towards the U.S. dollar losing its sole reserve currency status. And I feel that as long as we run these policies, it's almost certain that that's going to happen. And because of that, the dollar should be going down. The value of the dollar is so high because we enjoy global reserve currency status, and we don't really respect it enough. We take it for granted, I guess. We seem to take a lot of things for granted these days in the United States, relative to how we thought about things in prior decades and generations. And I believe that we're setting the stage for us to, unfortunately, I use the word enjoy. I guess that's an experience, I suppose I should say, the consequences of our actions, the way we've been running a non-serious economic program now for really since 1980, but it's really accelerated so much in the past decade, and there's no signs of it abetting. So that's the reason why the dollar is going to go down, and it's already peaked. I mean, it peaked at the Dixie Index at 103. There was a double top in January of 2017, and then right after the pandemic hit, and now we're living down about 10% lower, and I believe the dollar is going to take out the lows of the past down cycle. See, the dollar has been in a series of declining highs for decades. It goes back to the 80s. And for that reason, I think when we get to the next break to the lower level, the dollar is going to go past the most recent low of around 80 and even take out the low of 70. So I think there's easily 25% downside in the US dollar. And with stocks so overvalued versus historical metrics, it means that other stocks, for US-based investors, buying stocks in foreign currencies, right now I prefer the euro, ultimately will be emerging markets, maybe starting next year, that's going to be the place to be.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting thesis you lay out there. I do want to bring up the Federal Reserve again. And of course, a lot of talk lately, Jeffrey, as you know, about taper talk, if you will. And we have the symposium coming up, the Jackson Hole symposium later this week. Not that we'll get any insight on tapering there, but what are you kind of looking for from the Fed? How are you thinking about what their next move might be?
Well, I'm certainly of the mind that the Fed is not thinking seriously about raising short-term interest rates as long as they're doing quantitative easing. So the taper was thought to be impossible for anywhere here in calendar 2021, but there's whispering behind the scenes. Some of the Fed officials are thinking that maybe they should start tapering even as soon as next month. I don't think that's going to happen. I think they're going to wait and see. They're clinging to this transitory or temporary inflation thesis. They've already been wrong on that. When they talked about this bump in CPI and other inflation being temporary, they kind of define that as being 2 or 3 months. But it's already been more than 2 or 3 months. Now they're talking about 6 or 9 months. I think if we go into December, if we end the year 2021 with inflation on the CPI headline above 5, which is about a 50-50 proposition, I think. We're at 5.4 right now. If it stays for the year at 5, then I think the Fed may start tapering, because the transitory inflation thesis will be very hard to defend at that point. Keep in mind that the PPI, which is wholesale prices, which lead CPI, on the headline are 9.6 or something like this. I know it's a 9 and change, and on the headline it's 4.3. So the Fed policy is going to depend completely on whether or not these elevated inflation levels can endure. And with commodity prices having stabilized but not dropping, I think it's a fair bet that inflation is going to continue to be stubborn on the upside. And with that happening, taper becomes more of an issue and more talked about. But I don't expect tapering is going to happen. I would think maybe December at the earliest.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey, my colleague Brian Sazi has a question for you. Brian?
Jeffrey, yes. Just following up on what you were saying about the Fed, given that you do see stocks as overvalued, when the Fed does taper, how disruptive do you think that will be to stock and bond markets?
Well, it certainly would be negative for the stock market. As I pointed out, the expansion of the Fed's balance sheet goes in lockstep with the capitalization of the S&P 500. And when we saw when they tried to taper in 2018, the stock market had a sort of mini crash, actually went into a very compressed bear market in the fourth quarter of 2018. And it forced the Fed to completely change their activity. So it has a negative effect on the stock market. For bonds, what's weird is when the Fed is tapering, historically, yields have actually fallen. It's weird. It's kind of counterintuitive. But historically, that's been the case, that yields have fallen when the Fed has tapered. And now the Fed has been expanding their balance sheet, actually, treasury rates have risen. They were at a crazy low level. Once we went into lockdown, the 30-year treasury bond actually got down to 1% on a closing basis. And then the Fed reacted with massive stimulus. And now the 30-year treasury bond, it's not tremendously higher, but it's up at, you know, it's up at about, you know, 1.85 or so. So as they've been doing this quantitative easing, stocks have gone up and bond yields have modestly gone up. And so counterintuitively, a lot of people understand, they think this tapering, bond yields will go up, but historically the opposite has been the case. So it would probably mean bond yields stay subdued and stocks would fall.
Jeffrey, I have one question for you on the economy, and I'm so glad to have you here today. So we had consumer sentiment crater just the other week, yet we also have job openings at 10.1 million, which is incredibly high. And then when you look at GDP, we're essentially flat from Q4 of 2019, yet we're flat, but with 5.8 million fewer workers. So productivity has gone up. How do you kind of think about the overall economic picture here, especially, you know, given all of that as a backdrop?
Well, the economic picture is very, very hard to divine ever since the government got so involved in the economy. And they've made so many, it's like pushing on like a waterbed or something. You know, if you push on the side of the waterbed, the other side goes up and weird things happen. And you can't really compare it to a time period where you're not pushing on the waterbed. So it's very hard to discern what's going to happen. But certainly the employment situation that you point out is really fascinating, and it's kind of seminal to the screwed up nature of the economy. Everywhere you go, almost any profession you ask, they say that they have a hard time getting workers. Well, no surprise, people are making more money or the same amount of money by not working, and the government continues to support that. So what will happen when these stimulus programs ultimately end, or people actually have to start paying their rent? There's going to be tremendous economic disruption. The officials have a tiger by the tail, and for now, they are not getting clawed or mauled by the tiger. But if you let go of the tail of the tiger, you're going to very likely get mauled. And that's what's going to happen. If you ended that, you don't have to pay your rent, the eviction moratorium, there's going to be all kinds of consequences to that. Rents are going to go way up if that happens, I think. Also, people are relying on stimulus, and the stimulus is responsible completely for this economic growth. You know, GDP is 70% consumption. And as this economy has rebounded back on a GDP basis, it's done so with tremendous increase in the trade deficit. Multiple percentage points of GDP have come from an increase in the trade deficit. And that's not real GDP. Consumption is not really the economy. The economy is about production. And when you buy goods produced in Asia with stimulus money, it shows up as GDP, but it's really Asian GDP. It's consumption in the United States. So the economy isn't really that strong. As you point out, with 5 million fewer jobs, it shows up as correctly mathematically in the productivity equation, but it's really Chinese productivity. Because again, if you just consume goods, you're not really having economic growth. You're just having consumption, but we define it as economic growth. So it'll be fascinating to see what happens when these programs end. I saw that the $300 unemployment supplement is being curtailed on schedule, but states still have a lot of money that hasn't been dispersed. So the stimulus on states' discretion could continue longer, even though it's now no longer being funded weekly by the federal government. But when it all ultimately ends, we're going to see, well, this is people talk about the stimulus and the Fed's low interest rates as a punch bowl. And certainly this has been a very deep punch bowl, spiked pretty heavily, you know, with 100 proof liquor. And once this party ends, the hangover is going to be in the form of sharp drop in economic growth. I think one of the reasons consumer sentiment dropped so much, just cratered at the most recent reading, has to do with the fact that people are aware that maybe the stimulus is getting a little shakier in terms of our ability to predictably rely that it's coming again. And also the misery index, which I think Ronald Reagan created, which is the sum of unemployment and inflation. Once it goes over 10, they call it misery, and it's at 11.3 right now, the sum of CPI, headline, and unemployment. And maybe the consumers are feeling the inflation. I think people are starting to realize that inflation's out there. If you ask people what is the big thing that's worrying you about the economy, overwhelmingly right now, what comes across is inflation, because people see it at the gas pump, they see it at the supermarket, And as long as there's stimulus happening, I see food inflation is continuing.
Well, Jeffrey Gundlach, founder and CEO of Double Line Capital, I thank you so very much for stopping by Yahoo Finance Live today.